We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we will be talking about work in America and in the world, about work and employment now, how it has changed, how we expect it will continue to change, something we thought it was appropriate to do as we are approaching Labor Day. Certainly, we know that in the last couple of years, the country has lost a lot of jobs. There was some growth, although nothing to get really excited about. In July, unemployment was 9.1%. 13.9 million people were out of work. And of course, the news today, certainly everyone has heard it. The economy showed no job growth in the month of August. So we still have an unemployment rate of 9.1%. That's the first time there has been a monthly lack of job growth in this country since 1945. So that picture looks pretty dismal. However, what we want to try to do this morning is maybe dig down a little bit deeper and go below those numbers and try to talk a little bit about what's happened with work in this country in recent decades and, again, where we're headed. And we're happy to have two guests with us. Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld is the dean as the dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's with me here in the studio. Also joining us, Rosemary Bott. She is Alice H. Cook Professor of Women and Work at the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell University. And she's joining us from there. We want to thank Cornell for providing this high-quality connection. It sounds like she's here with us, but she's in Ithaca. Also, we want to thank Bert Odom Reed, who's the engineer on that end. Now, as we talk, I expect there will be people listening who will want to ask questions, and you can do that by calling 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And there's the email, so if you'd like to send in a question that way, you can do it. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take as many as we can. People can help us by being brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. So we want to say to our guest here in the studio with me, Professor Kutcher-Gershenfeld, thanks very much for being here.
It's truly a pleasure.
And from Ithaca, New York, Rosemary Bott. Professor Bott, hello.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks, and thanks very much for being with us. Just maybe we can just start out, you might reflect on that number, and then we can go on and talk a little bit more about maybe more specifically about the kind of jobs that have been lost and the kind of jobs that are gained. But how do you view where we are now, particularly now the numbers from August?
Well, I think that we need to add to the fact that in addition to the 14 million Americans who do not have jobs, there are another 8.4 million workers working part-time who want to work full-time, and another almost 3 million workers who are unemployed but have essentially given up looking for work. So we're really talking about some 25 million people who've been affected by this recession. And I think the we've talked a lot, and we should be focusing on this serious unemployment issue. But today, this idea of focusing on also those who are continuing to work is really important because, after all, their jobs have become much harder. They have now have the pressure from their families of being perhaps the sole earner in the family. They have to supply the livelihood. They're also probably getting more pressure from their employers at work to work harder, to work longer hours because their employers have had to cut workers. And so the workers who are continuing.
I think that we lost our connection with our guest. We'll see if we can restore it. If not, we can always put her on the telephone.
But let me
pick up
right where Rose was talking, because she's exactly right. The focus on a Labor Day show is both on those who are most disadvantaged in the workforce. And it is true that there are approximately 78 million families in this country, and a good 9.7 million or 12% of families have someone who is unemployed. But as Rose points out, there are quite a few discouraged workers who aren't even showing up in the numbers. But I guess what I'd like to do is to even take a bigger step back to the big picture, if you will. If we go back 45 years ago, it was the end of World War II. It was a time when many of the schools like Cornell in Illinois and other schools represented in the Employment Policy Research Network, which we're both coming here on behalf of, were founded. And we were founded because in those immediate post-war years, collective bargaining was on the table in society as a potential engine to build a middle class, but it was hotly debated. Healthcare and pensions were being debated, whether to have an employer-based or a government-based system. We had veterans returning, and education was on the table with the GI Bill and other investments that society was making in education. If you fast forward to today, remarkably, collective bargaining, healthcare, pensions, education, veterans are all still on the table, combined with technology, the accelerating pace of change, globalization. So as we go into Labor Day, the number of issues that relate to labor and employment that are literally on the table in our society in deep and sometimes polarized ways is vast. And so our agenda is indeed a broad one. And so, you know, with that, I think we can describe a very large territory that we may cover in the show.
Sure. Well, I think we have Professor Bott back with us now. She's on the telephone. Professor Bott?
That's right.
Great.
Yes,
well, I'm very happy to have you. This is not quite as nice, but we've got you. So that's okay. The important thing. And I don't know if you would like to try to go back and try to pick up where you were when we lost you. You want to round out that thought.
I'm not sure where you lost me, but my main point was that with including part-time, involuntary part-time workers and unemployed who have given up looking for work altogether, we're looking at about 25 million Americans who've been affected by the recession in terms of their employment. And this spills over into having an effect on the working lives of people who remain working, because the pressure is much greater for them to produce the livelihood for the entire family. Their employers probably have laid off, so they're doing the work of two or three people on the job. And so the intensification of work for those people who are working has increased. And so we need to look at the kind of wide panorama of issues, as Joel was saying a minute ago.
And, you know, I think that something that I'm sure that you would want to focus on and something that whenever we talk about work or often it comes up, and that's the subject of wages. And I think that some people would argue that the one thing that has happened in the workforce that's enabled people to maintain a standard of living that they aspire to is that now in most households we have two wage earners, where there would have been a time within the post-war period where maybe we only had one. And that's what happened is if you look at wages and you adjust for the value of money over time, you have to say that at the very least that they've been stagnant, if not worse.
Absolutely. In fact, the numbers on income decline and income inequality, particularly for the decade of the 2000s, even before the recession, are quite staggering. So just a couple of quick numbers. 90% of Americans saw their overall income decline between 2000 and 2007, before the recession. And all of the growth in income went to the top 10%. And in fact, in 2007, before the recession, fully 24% of the income growth went entirely to 1% of the population. So what we've seen is an enormous stagnation or decline in the income available to Americans, at the same time that we see this greatest inequality since the 20s. And, of course, seeing the people at the top who are doing so well also provides it rubs people, right, who have been seeing their income decline in a very negative way.
Some of our colleagues have referred to this as the Great U-Turn. We had a period of 20 or 30 years in the post-World War II era where income inequality actually was reduced. It was exemplified in the auto industry by what was called the annual improvement factor, where there was 3% year-over-year gains in productivity matched by 3% year-over-year gains in wages. And so the consumer was protected. It didn't come out of their pocket. The wage gains came out of productivity gains. Starting in the 70s, real wages started to go flat, and that's when we saw second wage earners coming into the workforce. Many women entered the workforce, and household income continued to keep pace with productivity growth. But a decade or so later, that too went flat, and it was, you know, both real wages and household income then that weren't matching pace with productivity growth. And so people started to increase debt. And, of course, we hit the wall on that. So we have a situation of really three or four decades of rising inequality that, frankly, has accelerated lately.
Yeah. Well, one thing maybe this is, in a sense, going over a little bit of the same ground, but I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the if you look at jobs that have been lost and then jobs that have been created, and you compare those these jobs, you look at salary, at benefits, at working conditions, is that equivalent? Is that kind of a, you know, match those things job for job? Or would you say that, in fact, the jobs are being created? Do not compare well with the jobs being lost.
Rose is the exact person to talk about that because it's right. A shift to the service economy.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so if you take the, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but if you take the top 10 occupations that have been growing in the economy, about 7 of the 10 are low-wage service jobs. They're things like health care, nurses' aides, and cleaning and janitorial, and housekeepers in hotels, their customer service representatives in call centers. And so the growth of the low-wage jobs is enormous, and there are a few IT, high-tech types of jobs also increasing at the top, but overall it has exacerbated a kind of polarization of jobs between the very good jobs and the very poor jobs with a hollowing out in the middle. And if I could give you just one quick example, since the recession, so since 2007, the only sector that has been adding jobs has been the healthcare sector. It has grown every year and added jobs. However, just to give you an example, 200,000 jobs were created for home health aides. Those are people who are going into homes and taking care of the elderly or the sick. Those jobs pay less than $10 an hour and have absolutely no benefits or protection. So that is an example of the kind of jobs we're often creating in this new economy.
Mm-hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce our two guests. Joining us by telephone is Rosemary Bodd. She is a professor of Women and Work in the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell University. Here in the studio with me, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He's dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the changed and changing nature of work and employment in the 21st century. And from people who are listening, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing we certainly know is that the issue of jobs and job creation has been maybe the number one next to the issues of deficit and spending issues in Washington going into the presidential election. It may be job creation may be the big issue. I think we could expect to hear a lot about this. And we'll be hearing people advance their plans for that. Every time we come to this subject, though, I find myself wondering, truly, what can government, Congress, president, a governor do to create jobs? Can, in fact, government do very much to create jobs?
Let me start on that because it's a question, it is the question, and I think there's a couple of different ways to answer it. First, the Federal Reserve Bank in its mandate has a mandate both to prevent inflation and to promote full employment. And for most of the last 4 or 5 decades, most of the policy tools that it's used have been targeted at inflation and monetary policy with less of a focus on full employment, although going into this recession, the Federal Reserve was quite proactive, and it was well within its mandate, and I expect that it will continue to take seriously this issue of jobs. But I think there's a larger issue here. If you look around the world, many nations are wrestling with this issue, and in nations other than the U.S., they're doing it in a much more thoughtful and comprehensive way. So Australia had a fairly institutional policy around collective bargaining accords at an industry level. Then it had a right-wing government that came in and tried to focus on individual employment contracts. And now the pendulum has swung back to the middle in a very constructive way. They passed a new set of laws called Fair Work Australia that wants to both make sure people are treated fairly in the workplace and help the country as a nation compete in the global economy. In Brazil, in Scandinavia, in Korea, in many countries, they're trying to figure out how to find that balance. Sadly, in this country, we have deep polarization on these issues. And what we need is evidence-based, constructive, problem-solving dialogue on the way to find that high road where you have good jobs that both have good wages, good working conditions and fair treatment, and good economic performance in the economy by individual firms and as a whole. About 10% of the U.S. workforce is in the category of true high-performance organizations that are on that high road. So we have models out there. What we don't have is a systematic effort to lift up those models, to value them, to understand what makes them work, and to see how they can apply across the broad range of jobs we have in the economy.
Hmm. Professor Bott, anything you might want to add?
Yes. Well, I think that what the government did with the stimulus did help create jobs. There's some pretty good research now coming out to put some numbers on that. And most of us, many of us would argue that the stimulus wasn't big enough. But what we did see is that the stimulus really did stabilize communities by helping state and local governments keep public sector jobs alive. And that meant teachers and firefighters and policemen and a whole host of services that are absolutely necessary in communities. And those stable incomes had spillover effects throughout those communities and helped sustain them. Now, with the drying up of the stimulus and the attack on the public sector, we're seeing that the public sector jobs are declining. That is contributing to the unemployment and the dismal unemployment picture. And so we need to reverse that. And we can leave aside the debate for a minute over the political will and whether it's possible, but the government can play a very, very important role in stimulating jobs, in stimulating employers to create jobs. Currently the corporations are sitting on millions and millions and millions of dollars of cash that they are not investing in creating jobs. They have the money to do so, and we need to ask them why they are not investing in jobs and what it would take to stimulate them to do so.
We have a caller to bring into our conversation. Let us do that. It is someone who is listening this morning in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
This is very fascinating, and thanks for being here. But it seems to me that there are a couple things that are going on that you're talking about, and that one is a very long trend, and that the labor movement was, in essence, it began to be crushed during the First World War and its aftermath, and that the shift, the government and capital figured out how to control it, and the government, since that time, has supported corporations and capital. And now that globalization has occurred, no longer do the corporations and capital need to get along with the people in their towns or their mill towns or whatever, which don't exist anymore? Now they can shop for very cheap wages all over the world, and it seems that there's absolutely no incentive. So when Congress and the president talk about job creation, it's laughable, because there's no incentive whatsoever to keep money here to invest in the United States. So I was trained as an artisan, and now I'm an academic, but the original job is gone. And most of those good paying work jobs are gone. And I really, your comment about the Fair Work Australia, well, with our quote right to work laws, I don't see anything like that happening here. So anyway, those are my comments.
Well, that's a lot, Joel.
Actually, I really appreciate the caller's comments, and Rose will, I think, step back and talk about the larger picture of globalization in a moment, because the caller, you know, has focused on how the rules of the game have changed with the mobility of capital on a global basis. And that is true, that and all nations are wrestling with that. But I will also say that that doesn't mean that we should just despair. I was working with a utility and its union in which they were in negotiations, and the employer feared that the union was going to insist on a no layoff and no outsourcing policy because they were worried about jobs going away. And the union instead put on the table a very different request. Instead of a demand, it put in a question. And the question was, how can we be your workforce of choice? And instead of shutting down the discussion in a polarized debate, do they have the right to move jobs or not, it opened up a dialogue on what would make the employer choose to move work elsewhere versus choose to, in fact, invest in its own workforce. And it led to a whole workforce planning initiative that was quite positive. And so I'm going to start at the micro level and say more people should be having more constructive dialogue about how can we make these relationships work. There are a number of cases. Ford just brought 2,200 jobs back into the UAW because of efficiency improvements and understandings that they were able to reach. But let me stop there and have Rose step back and talk at a more macro level about the forces of globalization.
Yes, all advanced economies are facing this issue of corporations taking what were decent jobs here and moving them to low-wage countries. And I would note that this not only eliminates jobs here, but it also puts pressure on the existing jobs because, employers in the larger economy, in the global economy, feel under greater competitive pressure. And so there is an effort to reduce costs and intensify work. As we mentioned earlier, technology has brought about this accelerating change, so there's a constant pressure to be changing products and processes and putting more demands on employees to learn more. But employers also have more bargaining power to demand more of workers who are here. So that set of issues is very much present, as our caller mentioned, and it exists not only for the U.S. but other countries, as Joel mentioned. However, I do think that there are opportunities for investing in new technologies and sources of innovation, and there are lots of solutions out there. The question is whether there are the kind of the political will needed. I think the getting employers to work with labor around bringing manufacturing jobs home is one of the hardest issues. But I would also stress that there are many high-skilled, important knowledge jobs, innovative jobs, and important jobs to the economy that are not going anywhere. And those are in healthcare, they're in the sciences, they're in education, they're in the overhaul of our utilities and our power grid and our infrastructure development. And so there are a lot of opportunities to build good jobs here. I do think it depends on greater involvement of public subsidies or partnerships with the private sector so that there are incentives from the public sector to unite with the private sector to invest in jobs here.
Can I have just one follow-up?
Sure, yeah.
That
go
was
ahead.
The union asking, how can we keep jobs here? The premise of the labor movement as it formed way back in the 1800s was that the workers deserved some of the pie, more of the pie. But I don't see there being the leverage to do that anymore. And I don't even see in the workforce in general people understanding that when there's a strike, it's because the workers need more and the investors need to make less profit. There's nowhere is anybody saying, IBM shareholders should not make gouge, the workforce for enormous profits or whatever corporation. And the rules now are set up to support the concentration of wealth. And someone said, I can't remember who it was, that the limited liability corporation is the greatest engine of wealth concentration ever devised by man. And it truly is. And Mussolini further said that fascism is the perfect marriage between the state and the corporations. And I believe we have an American fascism. Oh, thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know if you want to, Joel, want to break up on this point. Particularly this point, I guess I'm interested in what you think about the idea that if the quality of jobs and benefits and wages have declined, does that have something to do, or is that somehow connected with the declining support for organized labor in the country and the fact that fewer and fewer workers are members of unions?
Well, we don't have to move into labels and ideology in order to engage the issue. At a very basic level, when workers in the U.S. are asked, would you like an organization to represent you in case of fair treatment or unfair treatment on the job and bargain on your behalf, a very large majority of U.S. workers say yes. And in fact, even if they're asked, would you like to join a union, a majority will say yes. But they're not all working in the same place, and there are certainly strong documentation of the ways in which the laws as they exist have, for some employers, been disregarded. And the result is that there is less of a check and a balance in society. Now, to be fair, some unions have been innovative, but many have been slower to change than they might have been. And so, the old model of unionism was that of withholding labor to extract power advantage. To some degree, that is still needed, although, as Rose pointed out, the power has shifted. But there is a new model of unionism that we see emerging, which is about enabling work. And unions still protecting the rights of workers, but also being concerned about work being done well, about quality, about safety, about other issues. And, as we move into the 21st century, all of the institutions of the workplace are ill-matched to our reality. So labor needs to improve. Business needs to really rethink that fundamental social contract with the workforce. And government needs to reinvent its role in a way that is pointed towards that high road.
We're talking here this morning as part of Focus about work, the changing nature of employment and work in the 21st century. We take a short break here. We'll have more in a moment. This is Focus.
Did you know that you can support WILL without sacrificing income that you may need during your lifetime? Leave your own legacy for the future of this station. Join the Legacy Circle visionaries who have provided a gift through their estate. You are an essential part of our future. For more information, call Donda Beard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. Just a quick mention that in an hour or two, Celeste Gwynn will be the host, and we'll be talking about dog care and dog behavior, and we do that every month. As always on Friday, Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm will be with us from the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. So if you have questions about your companion animals, as long as they're canines, we'll take him. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. If you'd like to look at the schedule for next week or listen to programs that you might have missed, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we're talking about work and employment, how things are changing in this country, where we are headed. We have two guests here in studio with me is Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He is the Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And joining us by telephone from Cornell University is Rosemary Bott. She is the Alice H. Cook Professor of Women and Work in the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell. So questions welcome. We have several, and we'll try to get as many as we can. Again, folks can really help us by trying to be brief in their questions. We'll go right on to another caller, and I do believe this will be line number two and in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. This is really an excellent discussion, and I really wish there were more of them. It's the major issue of the day. And I think there's a lot of public misunderstanding about job creation. My question relates to the real source of the problem. The problem, I think most economists would say, is slack demand. The demand for labor is derived from the demand for products. Businessmen are rational. They're not going to invest. They're not going to hire more people if there isn't sufficient demand for their product. The stimulus package effects have been estimated. Alan Blinder, for instance, and Moody's chief economist have done simulations, and they find that unemployment would be 14 to 18% now without the stimulus. So I wonder if you would address that matter. Why isn't more forthrightly the issue of slack demand being discussed, and how you increase demand with fiscal policy? There's a lot of attention to deficit reduction, but this is kind of inconsistent with creating jobs. And I wonder if you would speak to that point.
All right. Thank you.
It's a very good question. I don't have the exact numbers here, but when the bottom fell out of the economy, over $1.3 trillion disappeared from the economy. The stimulus was, I think, $800 or $900 billion that was put back in. And so clearly, if we had had another year of support to states and communities, that would have really helped us keep from sputtering in the way the economy is now. I think fiscal policy does matter. And as long as those are one-time commitments, not long-term engagements of policy commitments, the government can absorb that debt and it gets paid back as the economy returns. So the caller is right that there is important work that could still be done, and I know that's not the mood in Washington, but that is, what economists are suggesting is the reality with the macroeconomy numbers. I think there's a deeper issue as well. Employers have become very skittish about hiring because of the shock that they just went through. And so this is, by the way, our third jobless recovery in a row, so it's not the first time that we face this. But we essentially have employers being much more cautious on the upside after a recession about rehiring for individually rational reasons, but collectively the society suffers a slower growth recovery.
Let me ask you this question. This is a different question, but it's perhaps prompted by an email what we got from somebody who was interested in the issue of jobs being replaced, human jobs being replaced by robotics. And I guess I just think that one thing that certainly is true that we have seen over time is productivity, that is the productivity of the individual has increased. And I'm sure that in part that has to do with automation. So we have fewer people, but more is being produced in part because machines are doing some of the production. And maybe Professor Bott might like to speak to this. How much an issue is that? Perhaps mechanization leading to increased productivity, but that also means ultimately that you need fewer people.
Well, that is true, although that's been a part of the growth of the U.S. economy over the last century. More productive technology can reduce jobs, but it also can free up in money to be invested in other sectors or in more innovative activities. I think the problem is not with labor-saving technology, but what is done with the proceeds from that productivity growth. And just to give you an example, so the productivity has gone through the roof, but the share of productivity gains that actually go to wages has continually declined. So, for example, college graduates, while their wages grew by about one-third of the rate of productivity growth in the last two decades. So what happens to the money, that the profits that come from that productivity growth? Here is where I think there has been a major shift in the economy. We often call it financialization. But essentially, investors are making money by buying and selling companies. They don't invest in order to improve productive enterprises in order to create new innovative solutions and compete in the global economy. So if I can give you an example from a terrific book that was published about a year ago by Bill Lizanek called Building Sustainable Economy. He shows that firms have shifted their using their profits from investing in productive activities to stock buybacks. So what happens each year, the executives will take the retained earnings or profits, and rather than investing it in new production, they will use it to buy back their own stock in their own company, which boosts the stock prices of the company and in turn enriches the shareholders. To give one quick number, the leading IT companies, such as Microsoft, Cisco, Intel, Oracle, Texas Instruments, IBM, HP, these are companies that have been at the forefront of innovation. In the 2000s, their stock repurchase payouts exceeded their investments in R&D. So what does that mean? That gets to the heart of it. When you talk about stimulating demand, taking profits and investing them in new technologies and new innovations so that we increase demand for new products and keep the economy going that way. That's what we need to be doing.
Yeah, I'm going to join with Rose on this, that technology is not the evil party, so to speak, that the one thing that technology has brought to the table is an accelerating pace of change, and that has rippled through the workplace, through society in a variety of ways. But that technology engine has both upskilling effects and de-skilling effects, and new sectors and new jobs emerge with new technology. So it really is a question of, you know, the rules of the road for how much we are reinvesting in our economy as compared to, you know, the real tensions that go with this financial markets. We know how to deal with labor markets and product markets, and labor is a derived demand from product markets. But we really have to come to grips with understanding the intersection now of financial markets, which adds instability to the system.
We have some other callers here. We have about 10, 12 minutes. So we will go to the phones once again. This someone listening in Champaign and on line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose in a general sense, I take exception, although I agree with a lot of remarks that the ladies made, your professors made. I think that to a certain extent, labor and management have always been antagonistic. And in this country, certainly the history of labor has been a history of strife. And to a great extent, management has won. It is now triumphant. Unions are pretty much smashed, et cetera. Perhaps government's best role would be as an arbitrator between management and labor. And when you talk about things like investment, for instance, tax the corporation to the extent that you can spend that money on investment, on better education, et cetera, et cetera. I would argue the balance in this country has swung violently in favor of management in the top 1 or 2% of the people who control wealth, and I'd listen to your comments. Thank you.
I will say that there are still, in the private sector, about 17,000 collective bargaining agreements negotiated every year, and at least as many in the public sector. So even though the proportion of the workforce where unions are present has declined, there are still literally tens of thousands of instances of labor and management sitting down, finding common ground, and working together in their respective enterprises, and that is still an important part of the economy. There are also countless cases of new arrangements where progressive employers, even without a union, are figuring out how to work with their workforces in new ways. And so I would celebrate the high-performance partnerships in whatever institutional form they take. And so in that sense, yes, labor and management have competing interests and there is conflict, but they also have common interest, and there is much that we can do to expand the pie, not just figure out how to divide it.
Well, let's take another caller here. We have a couple. Let's go to Urbana next, line 1. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
You may detect a little frustration in my voice. Both guests have looked to the government as a mechanism of providing solutions. And we've heard from a lot of sources that the government is essentially owned and operated by corporations, and the Supreme Court validated that in their decision on citizens. So looking to the government for the solutions is looking to the corporations for solutions. And their solution is to make more profit for the corporation, and that's their job. So I don't, and the direction that's being taken, certainly of the government substantiates that in the current tax structure. So I'm a bit sanguine about the government being the solution. Also, if the government has to, as Daryl Issa has said, in order to provide, the government should be providing incentives to bring back the trillions of dollars offshore that American investors have sequestered away. That seems to be going contradictory to what capitalism is. I thought the incentive in capitalism was profit, and now we're asking the government to provide the incentive to business to make more money, to concentrate wealth even more. And that seems, again, antithetical. If the government was investing more in education, the teachers would be spending their money. The people in the top 1% of the food chain in this country are obviously not spending their money. They're hoarding it, or they're investing it offshore. So,
yeah, again, and we're getting into about our last 5-6 minutes. I appreciate the points of the caller. And again, I want to go to the guests. Well, let me hand it over to Professor Bott. What do you think?
Yes. Well, first of all, I agree with a lot of what was said by both the last two callers. The balance of power has shifted to corporations, and that means that the government has become more captive to the interests of the people who have the most power. And so when we talk about government solutions, and that I don't in any way mean to suggest at the federal level only, but at state and local levels, we have to couple that with a recreation of government in the interests of the majority of people, and that means having a much more robust political movement or social movement that represents the interests of the majority of people rather than corporations. So the government solutions are entirely premised on the idea that the representatives in government have been elected by the majority of working people who have an agenda to do a much better job of enforcing labor and employment laws, do a much better job of regulating the financial sector in ways that make sure that the profits are reinvested, or that there are tax rules that prevent the worst behavior and that provide incentives for the kinds of things that will build a sustainable economy in the U.S.
And the specific issue of Citizens United was a case that we discussed in an earlier WILL show. It is true that that Supreme Court decision did enable both corporations and unions to make increased contributions to political parties, and that some of the attacks on public sector collective bargaining really represent a concerted effort to erode labor in its ability to influence the political scene, independent of the merits of what's happening in labor relations. And, of course, a big casualty in that area has been the demonization of public sector workers, the vast majority of whom care deeply about their work. And these are people who do child protection, environmental protection, and other very important work in our society. So on this Labor Day, what you're going to hear is a call for checks and balances, a call for decency and fair treatment, and a call for resetting the rules of the road in a way that helps the economy as a whole do well, both the employers and the workforce. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to get one more caller here. Again, we have about 5 minutes, so the caller will help us by trying to be brief. But we'll go there to Urbana in line two. Hello.
I'll try to be very brief. Mm-hmm. A caller, I think two callers back, suggested that the object of capitalism was to make profit. And I would suggest that capitalism, in this country at least, is broken, and that is no longer the object. The objective of the people who run the corporations today is to increase their salaries as much as they possibly can. They have very little investment in the long-term interests of the corporations, and they have only interest in their own financial advancement. Supposedly, boards of directors should control this incentive. However, boards of directors are largely made up of the CEOs and other top officers of other corporations whose own board of directory is made up in part of directors drawn from the first corporation. So the entire system, in my view, is corrupt and broken. Would you care to comment on this? Thank you.
Okay.
I would be careful not to paint all of business with a single brush. There are quite a few small and medium-sized family-owned enterprises that are deeply value-driven. And to be honest, there are quite a few very large corporations where people in leadership roles make very responsible and thoughtful decisions on behalf of the communities in which they operate and the workforce. There are, however, folks who are at the other end of the extreme who are doing things that are irresponsible. And what Rose pointed out and what I would emphasize is that it's really protecting against the extremes of inappropriate behavior, not throwing out the entire system or painting it with a single brush.
Mm. We're here at the point we've finished pretty much have to stop. We could easily find enough things to talk about to go for another hour. Just I wonder if you have a final thought about what the kind of changes that we have been talking about will mean for how people think about their jobs and the people that they employ them.
I would start with a brief comment based on some friends that I saw a number of years ago. I had been in South Africa working with their Commission on Mediation, Conciliation, and Arbitration. And a number of years later, some friends came back to this country that we had worked with. And I asked them, you know, how are things going in employment relations in South Africa? And they said the one thing that everyone is talking about is how we don't want to be part of the race to the bottom. And in that moment, what I realized is that it's not just this country, but all around the world, no one wants to be on a race to the bottom, that in all societies, people want their children to do better, to have educational opportunity and growth. And so I think I begin with the assumption that we all want something better, and that the advice to a worker or an employer is to literally roll up your sleeves and sit down for the conversation and the many conversations, and really rebuild around yourselves the patterns which become the institutions that will work for the 21st century. That's the work that we need to do.
We'll have to give Joel here the last word, Professor Bott, as we're here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Rosemary Bott is Alice H. Cook Professor of Women and Work in the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell University, and we really want to thank the folks at Cornell for helping us set it up, and also for Bert Odom Reed's work at the technical end, at the other end of the connection there with Cornell. And here in the studio with me, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He is the Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign.
Indeed a pleasure.
And I do want to mention also as well that both of our guests are affiliated with something called the Employment Policy Research Network, a network of people like them, academics all over the country who are interested in labor issues. They have a website, and on their website you will find many reports, white papers, a lot of research on various topics that have to do with labor and employment. And anybody who is interested in reading in these areas can go to the website and they can see what's there. So thank you both very much. We appreciate it.
A pleasure. That we all want something better, and that the advice to a worker or an employer is to literally roll up your sleeves and sit down for the conversation and the many conversations, and really rebuild around yourselves the patterns which become the institutions that will work for the 21st century. That's the work that we need to do.
We'll have to give Joel here the last word, Professor Bott, as we're here at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Rosemary Bott is Alice H. Cook Professor of Women and Work in the Industrial and Labor Relations School at Cornell University, and we really want to thank the folks at Cornell for helping us set it up, and also for Bert Odom Reed's work at the technical end, at the other end of the connection there with Cornell. And here in the studio with me, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He is the Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign.
Indeed a pleasure.
And I do want to mention also as well that both of our guests are affiliated with something called the Employment Policy Research Network, a network of people like them, academics all over the country who are interested in labor issues. They have a website, and on their website you will find many reports, white papers, a lot of research on various topics that have to do with labor and employment. And anybody who is interested in reading in these areas can go to the website and they can see what's there. So thank you both very much. We appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
We'll take a break at this point, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news. And in the next part of Focus, Celeste Gwynn will be hosting the show, talking with dog trainers Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm, and they'll take your questions on dog care and dog behavior. So right now, an update on the markets, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City, grain futures are shrugging off the negative jobs report from this morning. The Labor Department reporting that in the month of July, there were no increases in jobs or decreases in jobs, at flat rate of zero, leaving the unemployment rate at 9.1%. The market pretty much digesting that information, suggesting that to some degree, at least today, that the market has disassociated itself from outside factors. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 8.59 is up 11.